And so we leave Penelope and Marvin, those true lovers of the air, held in the thrall of ecstatic bliss.
Listen, Whitney, just because you're Basie Turner's brother-in-law, you can't kiss my girl.
Eddie, skip it.
Oh, I don't care. I'll bust him in two.
If there's any busting to be done, I'll do it right in your silly nose, you brainchild of an idiot.
Mr. Turner, what did I do?
What did you do? You did everything. You just messed up a whole program, that's all.
Eddie, darling, I don't think you had your mind on your word.
Mind? If he has one, where does he keep it?
What's the good of me writing good stuff if you're going to butcher it?
Listen, Beppo, who said you write good stuff? As for you, Grant.
Turner, why don't you lay off, Eddie? It wasn't his fault.
He's getting married today. He's in a daze.
Well, Jessup, he can spend his days someplace else. And unless you stop making so many advances to my wife, you'll spend your day someplace else. You're fired.
Fired?
Yeah, fired. Washed up. Through. Finished. Let him gum up somebody else's radio program if he can get a job.
Macy Turner, you're a mean, contemptible...
Of course, my darling husband, I can't stop you from firing.
No, I'll say you can't.
Naturally not. You've done that already. But I thought I might persuade you to hire him back again. Because if you don't... I thought you'd see it my way. I think it's an awfully nice thing of you to do.
Eddie, Macy's decided to give you your old job back and at a raise in salary.
Yeah?
It's a wedding present for you and Sue.
Do you hear that, Sue? A raise in salary.
Oh, thank you.
Come on, we gotta get dressed for the wedding. Don't forget, folks, 2 o'clock.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And you know, if you've listened to this show at all, that those are the dulcet tones of Michael H. Price, the writer, artist, musician, and man of many talents, and writer of many books, and talker about many movies, which is what we're doing here tonight.
Yeah, boy.
Now, what we're going to be talking about is a film. It's kind of a hard film to find, actually. It's called The Ghost That Walks Alone. Came out in 1944. A Columbia B, if there ever was a Columbia B.
Boy, I tell you, I do love those Columbia Bs, even when they're not up to a certain standard.
Which may be the case with this one.
Well, you know, it's like I've been reading some really snarky amateur comments on this picture, and well here's a picture that should never have been released,
right. Mm-hmm.
or the old hackneyed saying, well, this movie never was released, it must have escaped.
Must have escaped. And it's not that bad.
It's just a hell of a fun little picture.
Yeah, and they kind of fumbled it away at the end, I think, but, you know.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, that was, hey, come on, we're running out of film, let's wrap this up.
That's right, exactly. It's got that feeling, but...
But well, it pleased a lot of people in its day.
Yeah, I mean, it was a B picture.
For reasons we'll get into.
Yeah, it was Lou Lander's B picture. I mean, there was nothing more.
Louis Friedlander. What a checkered resume he has.
Boy, does he ever.
Ooh-wee.
To give a little background on the picture, it was based on a book, like so many A and B pictures were back in those days. And the book was called The Wedding Guest Set on a Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course,
Richard Shattuck.
And the title comes from the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Well, there's a pedigree for you.
There you go. And then later on, when it was one of those little Mercury paperbacks, it became The Body in the Bridal Bed. But what I have kind of divined from my research is that the book, I've not read the book, but I've read about the book, and the book is kind of racy for its time. In fact, there's a scene that really doesn't exactly have an analog in the movie. There's a scene in the book in which the honeymooning bride gets in bed. It's suggested she has no clothes on with the corpse, which in 1940 was pretty hot on a number of levels. Because
I wonder if George Butgerite ever saw that book.
I don't know.
Necromantic.
That's a very good question. But also that also has sort of echoes of the weird menace pulps as well, with their land of death and sex and sadism and things. But anyway, it was based on The Wedding Guest Set on a Stone, which was a pretty well-reviewed book. Columbia optioned it, and they ended up with this film called A Ghost That Walks Alone, which does not have a ghost that I can see, or does it have anybody really who walks alone in all of it. So it may have just been some sort of a title that tested well or that somebody came up with. I have no idea. But the idea is that Arthur Lake, who was on hiatus, the Blondie series, Michael, I think from my reading, I understand the Blondie series was on hiatus for a couple of years. Would that be right?
That's right, between 43 and 45. And, of course, they had to do something with Arthur Lake, who was a popular favorite.
Right, they had him under contract, I'm sure. Yeah.
Right, and so this is, whether they owed him a picture or he owed them a picture, it's kind of beside the point.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is, and I think they did the same thing with Penny Singleton, who played Blondie, because they put her in Go West, Young Lady, with Bob Wills, of course.
There you go.
And
that's exactly the situation.
So they were finding him working B picture in the same, because the Blondie and Dagwood pictures were, of course, B pictures.
And the Blondie and Dagwood pictures were immensely popular. And, of course, when they resumed, it was too great popular acclaim and great critical disdain.
Yes. Which is
and
usual,
so what are you going to do?
What is this, but, like you say about Laurel and Hardy, nobody loved them but the people.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. That's where the B picture has its great cultural value, because it really does give the people what they want, and sometimes it does so by avoiding that lowest common denominator.
Right. Would you like to go on with that thought? Because I think I know where you're going, but it's pretty intriguing.
The Ghost That Walked Alone, of course, I should point out that the biggest complaint among the amateur self-appointed critics is, well, there's no ghost in that picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, okay, well, you could say there's a figurative ghost. I don't know what. But it's really about the turmoil that can ensue when one's career gets in the way of one's married life,
mm-hmm.
or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a great deal of backstage radio shenanigans, being basically an attempt to continue a radio broadcast live from a remote location when things are going wrong in the studio.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that kind of throws it into that, as you call it, rubber reality domain that we have observed in that wonderful Burt Gordon picture called So You Won't Talk. I'm sorry, not So You Won't Talk. How Do You Do?
How Do You Do, yes.
So You Won't Talk is a kindred film, also a Columbia, with Joey Brown in kind of a rubber reality situation.
Which, of course, was made famous much later by one of my biographical subjects, Wes Craven, in stuff like Wes Craven's New Nightmare and, of course, The First Nightmare on Elm Street.
Right, yeah. And it is no coincidence that the great, well, of course, in the French New Wave and related European filmmaking movements, you find these rubber reality pictures championed as Dadaism or Surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
Or, but, you know, I mean, it's no accident that Fellini in particular admired the B pictures for their free reign with perceived reality.
Right. Right.
And so, yeah, well, we're making art here, or is the art making us?
Right. Good point.
I don't know.
Right.
But, yeah, of course, and Wes Craven's New Nightmare was just as much a response to Fellini as Fellini was a response over the long term to the B picture scene from Hollywood.
And, you know, I would also add, maybe, as I said in my Wes Craven biography, A Man and His Nightmares, I would also suggest that when Wes Craven went to Project Greenlight, when he was ultimately playing himself in a reality show, that was the final twist of the rubber reality.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that gets kind of into a little head trip there. I don't know that we want to stay on that, but this is the same thing. It's people creating, as you say, creating escapism or creating art, and it's a film created to have as its subjects the people who are creating the film. In this case, a radio show called The Tinder Hour, which is a soap opera. And Arthur Lake is a special effects guy, and his new wife, Lynn Roberts, is in it as well. And they're getting ready. It looks to me like they're trying to tell you the Tinder Hour is not doing very well. And they have a producer who's a very unpleasant man. There's lots of unpleasant people in the radio business in this. I thought that was one of the most interesting things.
What are they doing here?
I told them the lodge was closed.
Never mind what you told them. You promised me you wouldn't lose your temper again. Go back to the kitchen. Now, will somebody be good enough to tell me what this is all about? Who are you people?
They're friends of Eddie's and mine, Millie. We work on the same radio program together. But I haven't the slightest idea what they're doing up here.
Yeah, can't a guy have a little time alone on his honeymoon?
It was Macy's idea. Huh? Tell them all about it, Macy, darling.
Yes, perhaps you'd better tell us.
Yes, perhaps you'd better tell us.
All right, little Sirico, I'll tell you. If you'd have kept your big mouth shut and listened to me when I was talking to you on the phone yesterday, I'd have told you then.
You did tell us. You told us we were going to have to postpone our honeymoon. And if you think...
Will you shut up?
Hey, don't talk to Sue like that.
I'll talk to her any way I want. I heard what you told him to say on the phone. It's wise dames like you that start...
Hey, listen, you!
Oh, Eddie!
Oh. Listen. Wait a minute.
I thought you said these were friends of yours.
He's no friends of mine, and he can't talk to Sue like that.
Take it easy.
I'll kill him.
Take it easy. When did you get to be such a fire eater?
That, except for a couple of them, they're really pretty unpleasant, including the producer who loses his life. Arthur Lake essentially plays Dagwood. He's very goofy in the whole thing. And I must point out that Tom, who is Lake's, I believe, brother-in-law in that, his sister is the one who runs the hotel where they finally flee to have their honeymoon, only to be joined by the rest of the radio cast.
Right.
Tom is Matt Willis. And we talked about Matt Willis a few weeks ago on one of our shows, because Matt Willis was the guy who, with Mickey Dolenz's mother, wrote Pillow Time that ended up on the Monkees album. And he was also the werewolf in Columbia's Return of the Vampire. So I suspect Columbia may have had him on retainer, you think, or had him as a contract actor.
He was on contract, under contract at Columbia, and he had a great face for villains or red herrings.
Yes, he did.
And I won't tell you which he represents in this picture.
And speaking of great faces, and she's unbilled, God bless her, but how about the woman who plays the little old lady that they continue to call a zombie, just like they call Matt Willis's character a Dracula? They call the old woman a zombie, and her name is Ida Moore. And when you see her, you'll recognize her immediately. She did a ton of TV shows and a lot of different things, and she is the goofy old woman in this who also may or may not be a red herring.
Right, exactly, and it's wonderful stuff. You know, I mean, what a face she was. She was one of those unforgettable faces. You couldn't remember the name long enough to forget it.
Right.
But the audience for B Pictures and early day television will recognize her like right off the bat.
Absolutely. And you talk about the movie and the title and whether or not there are ghosts, and I suppose metaphorically there are ghosts in this, but the tagline, one of the taglines that I found out was "Murder in the air, ghosts out to scare, dead men in your hair." That was one of the taglines for The Ghost That Walks Alone. And it's very simple. I mean, it gets in and out pretty fast. Lou Landers was very good at that. I mean, he gets out just a 60 minutes and change. You're done on the picture.
Oh, yeah.
And you were talking about Lou Landers a little earlier. You want to talk a little bit more about him? I know you've studied him some.
Fascinating talent. Had a long career in the genre pictures. He was he kept as busy as good old Bill Bodine.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Sam Neufeld,
right.
That is in terms of picture after picture after picture after picture, and a career that, like Bodine and like Neufeld, extended well into the post-war period, having started in late silence for Bodine, but certainly all three of those extremely prolific,
mm-hmm.
Some might say hack directors, had started out early, stayed late, and always delivered the goods, not
right.
necessarily, you know, that's what we call the traffic cop school of film directing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're capable of delicacy and nuance and all those fine touches, but the main function of the traffic cop director is to get things blocked and shot in as few takes as possible.
That's right. Move
and
on
to
the next
market.
Setup. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But then again, Landers had there's an acknowledged classic genre film called The Raven from 1935.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the distinctive combinations of Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi.
Yes.
But he worked under his authentic name, Louis Friedlander, well into the 30s, and then changed to Lou Landers, and he got involved with Columbia, of course.
Mm, of course he did, yeah.
And was there a contemporary with William Castle,
mm-hmm.
Among the B unit directors.
William Castle just really starting his career at that time.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And Landers or Friedlander just tearing it up, you know. Quite a few pictures that fit into the so-called forgotten horrors niche, The Mask of Dijon with mm-hmm. Eric von Stroheim.
Mm-hmm.
The standalone Inner Sanctum picture.
Right, right.
That is the one Inner Sanctum that was not part of the Universal series by
mm-hmm.
that name.
Mm-hmm.
And then varying himself pretty wildly. Nice Kid picture, My Dog Rusty,
mm-hmm.
Son of Rusty. there was a whole Rusty series.
A lot of Rusties, yeah. Uh-huh.
And. And then some of the better Jungle Jim pictures, including one of my two ultimate favorite Jungle Jims, Forbidden Land.
I don't know that film. I've never seen it.
Jungle Jim and the Forbidden Land?
No, I've not seen
yeah.
it, Michael.
Oh,
maybe
well,
you
it's
gotta,
a...
Maybe we ought to take that on for a future show, Jungle Jim and
Jungle
the Forbidden
Jim
Land.
Is always a good topic because he's got a distinguished comic strip pedigree as
right.
well as an extensive history in the movie.
Right.
Yeah, Lou Landers did Forbidden Land, which is one of those cryptid pictures. That is, the race of... subhuman, superhuman creatures in a jungle setting.
So it's a lost race kind of picture then.
It's kind of thing like that, except the lost race resembles, like, is it an ape? Is it a werewolf? Is it
right.
a Bigfoot? I don't know. Just enjoy the movie.
That's right. Just sit back and enjoy it. You know.
Yeah, and one of our later forgotten horrors pictures, Terrified.
Right, right, with Rod Lauren. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Now, also working in this picture, a couple of people associated with Columbia for a while. Although Lynn Roberts was associated with Republic as well. You know, she did
mm-hmm.
what Phantom Speaks, which is one of our forgotten horrors pictures,
ooh,
as
yeah.
well as later on Port Sinister. She's in that one. She was Mary Hart for a while.
Mm-hmm.
She was Lynn Roberts. Then she tried Mary Hart out, and then she went back to being Lynn Roberts. And the femme fatale, sort of, or the other woman, I guess, in this picture is Janice Carter. Boy, she did a ton of Columbia B pictures. A couple of Whistlers. She's in a couple.
Yeah,
of Whistlers.
She was like the other Rita Hayworth.
Right. It's like what they said about Lynn Barry, Claudette Colbert with muscles. You know, I'd heard that line about it. I can't remember who did that line about Lynn Barry, but they were. It was such a rigid kind of system, you know, that I'm sure that, I know that Lynn Roberts and Janice Carter both did some Columbia A's, but they're down in the cast list a little bit.
Right.
And then they go back to the B's, and they're the leading ladies. And, you know, one of the things I think is interesting about this is that the people at the studios would buy books, would buy the rights, options for the books to make movies out of. And then, in particularly in this case, like I say, it seems to me from reading contemporary reviews that the primary draw of the Wedding Guest Set on Stone, from which the ghost that walks alone is taken, was that it was racy. Well, we were right in the middle of the Breen office days then, in 45, and all of the raciness that attracted whoever it was that bought the picture had to be completely leached out of the script.
Mm-hmm. There are nods and winks, but
right.
Those blue-nosed Jesuits, once they got hold of Hollywood establishment, you know,
That's exactly right. And
here is the lesson to the would-be censor even today. Leave that stuff alone. You're going to provoke them to subversion.
That's right. That's right. And then you get into Andre Gide and start talking about how art is born of constraint and dies of freedom.
You betcha.
There you go into all of that as well. But this is not art. This is just a pretty good little B picture. Clocks it in an hour and some change. I don't like the ending because they seem to have just sort of tacked it on, and it's just odd. But a lot of it is, it's certainly worth watching. It's certainly entertaining in its way, and it's a little bit hard to find.
Yeah, and if you seem to find yourself in want of finding it, bear in mind there really is no resolution. You kind of have to make up your own ending.
That's exactly.
I prefer to think that the benighted married couple lived happily ever after.
I'd like to think that too, Michael. But we're just romantics.
Yeah.
You know, we're just incurable romantics. That's the way it is. So, I have to tell you now, as we move into the second part, the small second part of our podcast tonight, we have to congratulate Joey and Emily. Joey, our producer, and we have in this house, he's being remarkably quiet. Matter of fact, he's quieter than your cat, Joey. Two-and-a-half-year-old Charlie, that would have happened fast, would it?
How about a week?
Yeah, two-and-a-half-week-old Charlie is with us, and that's why some folks might wonder why we kind of skipped a month there. That's because there was a lot of stuff going on that was, believe it or not, in some quarters, even more important than the Forgotten Horrors podcast. I know it's hard to believe, but it's absolutely true. So we want to say congratulations to Joey and Emily and to little Charlie as well. And it's just, it's great. It's great to see him. Came in and saw him. He looks great. I mean, you know, he looks like a baby, but you know, but he looks like a great baby. So it's really good. I can't help but notice, and I can't help but wonder if it's not because of these podcasts, at least partially, we have some forgotten horrors. You know, I just obsessively look at how my books are on Amazon. I mean, I'm sure I know it's a disease, but I see the Forgotten Horrors bouncing up there all of the time, and we seem to be getting some nice sales continuing with the series, which is very gratifying and certainly points to what you've done keeping the series alive after your collaborator George Turner passed away several years ago. Now, many years
ago.
Yeah,
well, 20-odd years ago.
20-odd years ago.
Nearly. In fact, yeah, I like to think that... I hope we are as good to our readers as they are to us.
Yes, absolutely. It's just, and also to the people listening to the podcast as well, because we hear from people that listen and that enjoy it, and we're very glad about that. We never, and Michael, I'm going to use not the editorial we, but the we for you and me and Joey. We never take anything for granted at all. We never think that we're doing something that people ought to automatically like and genuflect. We are genuinely happy to have people listening to it, and we're always glad to hear from you, too.
Well, if one writes to please oneself, one is, I think, automatically going to please a lot of other people, assuming that you can get your stuff out where people can get at it.
Right, that's exactly
and,
right.
And, you know, I mean, there were from 1979 until, about late 80s, early 90s, there was only one, no, I'm sorry, 1979 till 1999, there really was only one Forgotten Horrors book.
99?
That's the first
really?
Volume. George Turner finally consented to start working on a sequel 20-odd years after the first one. And I had to finish that second one posthumously, of course, although he had written several chapters.
Right.
And then had the old fire building up again. I said, okay, well, let's just take this. And then next thing you know, we've got a certain publisher demanding a sequel to the sequel and so on and so forth. I think the real turning point was when I incorporated the studio and took the publishing chores under my own banner.
Oh, I have no doubt about it. Did I start with you on 3 or on 4? It was
3. On volume 3.
Yeah, 3, and
yes.
George still had a few things left over, I remember.
And of course, I had inherited all of George Turner's film-going diaries from his younger days,
right.
So I had a lot of his opinions, many of which I actually agreed with, and you know, like that World War II film-going diary that George had maintained.
Mm-hmm.
That's a treasure.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and we keep on going now, and probably by the end of the year, there's going to be a couple of others, including the one that we've been talking about for a while under the auspices of Forgotten Horrors Presents, which is Fantasies in the Sand, I hope.
Yeah, the beach party phenomenon,
right.
Written large.
Writ large, we hope. That's right.
Yeah, well, we can only hope, and it's coming. It's kind of it's probably a crackpot theory that drives Fantasies in the Sand for us, but you know, when I get a hold of a good crackpot theory, I'm going to ride it until it busts.
I've always enjoyed crackpot theories myself. You know, I think it's, yeah, and I think it's a very good theory. We won't give away any more than that. What's new? What's the next thing coming out from Cremo Studios and you?
There will be 3 new Forgotten Horrors books at least, possibly a 4th. In order to mark the 40th anniversary of Forgotten Horrors in 2019.
Right. Oh, that's right.
One of them will be a collection of the artwork of my late partner, George Turner.
Good.
And so we're, you know, and not to give away too much, but since I did inherit all of his papers, I've got access to original artwork dating back to his childhood in the 30s.
Oh, my. Oh,
and so it's going to be quite a fun book and a comprehensive representation of his first published comic strip, The Ancient Southwest,
mm-hmm.
which of course is about dinosaurs.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
There was an interim edition several years ago, but this will be the first edition to go back to the original artwork and tear sheets.
Oh, okay.
So that's our old pal Steve Bissett swears that George's Ancient Southwest was the first dinosaur comic with a scientific basis.
Well, that's
as opposed to Alley Oop, which is
and
that's from 1950, 51, 52.
Okay.
So it's not before Alley Oop, but Alley Oop did not really concern itself with pure science, except in a sidebar feature.
Right. Exactly.
So there you go, and we just keep on having more fun than we know what to do with.
We're trying, and if anybody would like to contact the show, we have people from time to time contact us and ask us to talk about a show. Well, we'll talk about just about any movie you want to talk about, with perhaps the exception of The Bed That Eats People, which our producer Joey. But actually, we did talk about that and did an episode, so I guess anything's fair game. Joey, how do people, if people want to contact us, is on the Facebook page?
Yeah, Join the Forgotten Horrors Podcast.
Join the Forgotten Horrors Podcast Facebook page. It costs you nothing. And we're always happy to hear from you. So thank you. And thank you, Michael. It's always great. We'll reconvene shortly.
Terrific.